Zoe Jenny, the sky is changing. The rose bush was already there when they moved in. Someone must have planted it many years ago. Perhaps it had only been a little plant back then, and the person who put it in the earth never had the chance to see it in full bloom. Intertwined with the passion flower, the roses had climbed up and covered almost half of the brick wall at the back of the garden. The scarlet and purple flowers were so vibrant, it surprised Claire that something so beautiful was able to grow in this little dark backyard, and she couldn't help but hesitate before she snipped off a bunch of roses with the secateurs. There was something sacrilegious about it, like when she had taken that glorious orchid while on a walk, which hadn't wilted by the time they got home. Why did she have to take it? Wasn't it enough just to look at it? But this time, the flowers weren't for herself. Claire looked up into the bright blue sky and followed the white jet stream of a plane leaving London. How quickly this year had passed, she thought. How good the world was at looking normal and concealing its tragedies. "Let's go," Anthony shouted from inside the kitchen. "I haven't got all day." Claire smiled as she knew that while it sounded as if he had something very important to do, he just wanted to be back in time for the match. "You don't have to come, you know. I can go by myself," she said. He didn't even answer, just rushed out of the house instead. It was a hot, humid day. City Road was jammed with traffic and the line of buses moved sluggishly forward like a herd of ancient animals slowly dying in the sun. "Don't you want to try again?" Anthony asked tentatively when they reached Upper Street, Angel Tube Station just a few steps away. "It's only one single stop to King's Cross, you know." Claire shook her head. "You don't want me to have a heart attack, do you?" It happened shortly after the bombings a year ago, somewhere on the Northern Line. It was rush hour, and Claire had found herself pushed to the back of the carriage, unable to move. People were swaying with every turn, and she could feel the cumulative weight of the passengers smothering her. Her heart was racing in her chest so hard it was as if a living creature was trying to get out. "Calm down, for God's sake," she said to herself, but her heart just went faster. The noise of the creaking metal and rattling wheels cutting through the darkness at high speed gave her a drowning sensation. Staring at the door and counting the seconds, she remembered the expression, "soft target." She could die here with all these strangers in an instant, just like that. The fear and aggression in the air was almost palpable. Everyone on survival. Suddenly something inside her changed, a sudden diffusion of chemicals in her brain. She had to get out of there right then. With both her elbows, she pushed people aside. Someone swore at her, "stupid bitch," but she didn't care. She was someone else now, brutish, raw, animal-like. She would have punched anyone who dared to stand in her way. These weren't people anymore, just obstacles, stinking, hateful flesh. When Claire had finally emerged from the tube, stepping into the daylight, she was covered in sweat and out of breath, her mouth dry. Stumbling into the toilet of a nearby Starbucks, she looked at her face in the mirror. It wasn't just pale, it was as white as a sheet. Her knees weak and shaky, completely exhausted, she sat on the lid of the toilet seat to recover. She propped her head in her hands, ashamed of herself. She couldn't believe that she had behaved like that. For a brief moment, she had actually lost her mind. After that incident, Claire had decided to never ever go down there again and was relieved that Anthony didn't insist on using the tube, even though he was convinced it was just one of her fads that would be forgotten with time. Pentonville Road was a long stretch, and Claire carried the flowers head down so they wouldn't wilt as quickly in the heat. Anthony checked his BlackBerry and there was a happy birthday greeting from his mother. He read it somewhat disappointed, as if he had expected it to be from someone else. Claire felt sorry for him that they had to do this on his birthday, that this day was a day of grief for so many. She could see other people with flowers now, someone even carrying a giant teddy bear under his arm. A large crowd had gathered just a few metres to the right of King's Cross station entrance. There was a little square behind some railings with a tree in the middle, at night a seedy place where drug dealers and prostitutes hang out. Now, there were dozens of people creating a temporary memorial, and Anthony and Claire joined the queue, waiting for their turn. A security guard made sure that not everyone went in at once. Policemen were protecting the site, batons and guns at the ready. Most people just laid down their flowers and left, but some were kneeling in front of a photograph or wreath, praying. Even though King's Cross was a busy, noisy spot, on this particular day there was a strange silence, interrupted only by announcements from the loudspeakers inside the station. Claire was looking at the photographs and children's drawings. There were flowers everywhere, some still wrapped in foil, sweating away in the sun, releasing their sweet, heavy scent. The smell of death, Claire thought, and she laid the roses next to a photograph mounted on a piece of cardboard. It showed a young girl with short blonde hair. Underneath, in big red letters, was written, "Why?" A man next to her wept, holding onto the picture of a woman, almost tearing it apart. Suddenly he let go of it and left, looking around with darting eyes. He appeared completely lost, as if in panic, not knowing where to go. Eventually he disappeared into the shadowy hall of the station. They didn't talk on their way back. One of the reasons she loved him so much was that Anthony always seemed to know when it was time to be silent. She touched his hand with her finger, brief and gently, as if to reassure herself it was real, that if needed there was his hand she could grab and hold on to. The noise of the football on the telly filled the afternoon. It was a welcome distraction and had a comforting sound of normality, the rhythm of everyday life. Claire was in her room upstairs, sitting at the desk by the window, surfing the internet. There were speeches and readings in Regent's Park and several other commemorative events all over London. She found a website with photos and a short biography for each of the 52 victims. There it was again, the picture of the blonde girl. She was from Poland, 27 years old, and had been on her way to work that morning, perhaps thinking of her next trip back home to her family in Krakow when the bomb hit. They identified her because they found a fragment of her tooth in the rubble. Claire wondered how her parents had learned of her death. They couldn't get her corpse back in a coffin. There was no corpse. There weren't even ashes. Maybe one morning her parents had received a package bearing a London postmark containing that fragment of their daughter's tooth. Claire scrolled up and down the photographs. All these faces were still fresh in the memory of the public, but they would be soon forgotten. A year after the bombings, she had brought flowers, but would they do it the following year and the year after that? She doubted it. Claire realized that people die twice, and it's a second death that's final, when no one remembers you anymore. When all that remains of your existence is wiped out, then you are completely and truly gone. She turned off the computer. From downstairs, she could hear Anthony shouting and clapping his hands in excitement. Arsenal were winning. He would be in a good mood tonight, and they were going out to celebrate his 33rd birthday. Looking out of the window, Claire could see the evening sun about to disappear behind the rooftops and chimneys of Islington, the sky red and orange, slowly turning darker. Anthony was usually reluctant to do anything on his birthday, but when she told him they were going out for dinner with some friends, he seemed flattered that she had made the effort. He liked the Moroccan restaurant with its low, round tables and dark little corners where people could play board games and drink sweet mint tea served in tiny glasses. Sam, Christine and David were already there when they arrived, sharing a big mezze platter. Sam and Christine had just come back from India and their photos circulated around the table. Pictures of women in colourful saris on a backdrop of lush green, children on a roadside, waving, Christine on a bike, wearing a weather-beaten helmet. It had always been one of Sam's dreams, riding around India on a motorbike, and Christine had got a license just for the holiday. Claire was impressed by Christine's courage and the fact that she was 37, childless, and completely relaxed about it. One night she had asked her whether she was anxious to get pregnant. "We love to travel, and if it happens, that's great, but if it doesn't, I'm not going to beat myself up about it." Claire felt instantly relieved and comfortable in her company. Both Christine and Sam were teachers, and their double income and generous holidays allowed them to travel. They always seemed to have just come back from some faraway place, Easter Island, Galapagos, Vietnam. There was a constant whiff of adventure and foreign lands about them. Sitting next to her, Claire was admiring an intricate silver bracelet on Christine's tanned wrist that she had bought for next to nothing in a market somewhere in Rajasthan. "It would be impossible for you to leave Britain," said Sam in a loud voice to David. "You would die of hunger." David, one of Anthony's work colleagues, notoriously neurotic when it came to food, was raving about a place in Notting Hill where one could get wheatgrass shots. "Probably one of the reasons why you are still single," said Anthony, "is your grassy breath." They had tried to hook David up several times, but to no avail. Especially with Sadie, which had been the biggest disaster so far. "How could you send me a vegetarian?" she had said after she'd invited David to one of her dinner parties. Sadie was an excellent and keen cook and told them how David had picked out the vegetables from her slow-cooked beef casserole. For Sadie, this was not only a turn-off, but a complete insult. "A man who doesn't eat meat must be rubbish in bed," she once concluded. "My body is my temple," David had replied in his defence when they asked how the evening with Sadie had gone. "She even eats dead animals for breakfast." Anthony and Claire were laughing as he told them. "That's what it comes down to," Anthony commented. "Food. Even falling in love is dietary related. Sadie is a bloody carnivore and David's a cow. I can't believe we even let them near each other."